Okay, let's get our hands dirty. Vancouver in winter, it has its own quiet charm, but let's be honest, what we're really craving is that explosion of life that spring brings.
Definitely that green returning.
And if there's one thing folks around here take seriously, it's their gardens.
Oh, absolutely. Passionate gardeners here.
When spring hits, this city practically turns into one giant, lush botanical display. So, for this deep dive, we're zeroing in on the crucial steps to get your Vancouver yard thriving this spring.
Okay.
We're talking about waking up your lawn, giving your trees and shrubs a fresh start with some, smart pruning, planting for a vibrant splash of color, and just the essential care our unique local environment calls for.
And what's fascinating, I think, is that achieving that springtime vibrancy isn't just luck.
No.
No, it's a direct result of understanding our local conditions and taking specific, well-timed actions. It's less about having a green thumb and more about applying the right knowledge, really.
Absolutely. And that's where our deep dive begins. We've got a really comprehensive guide here, focusing on spring yard care right here for Vancouver.
Okay.
And our mission today is to pull out the golden nuggets, the information that will make the biggest difference.
Yeah, distill it
So
down.
you can jump in and get growing without feeling like overwhelmed by all the
Well, those
details.
key actionable
We're
steps.
aiming for those aha moments that make gardening feel less like a chore and more like, well, a rewarding connection with nature.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you could think of it like this. Your garden is a living system responding to the seasons. Our job as gardeners is to understand that transition from winter's rest to spring's awakening
Right.
and provide the right support at the right time.
All right, let's get down to earth, literally. First up, the lawn.
The green carpet.
It's the green carpet of our outdoor spaces, right? And our guide kicks things off with something you might overlook in the spring rush, making sure your mower is ready for action.
That raises a really interesting point. We often focus so much on the lawn's needs,
Yeah.
but the tool we use, the mower itself, is just as important. A poorly maintained mower can actually stress your lawn quite a bit.
That's right. We're talking about the fundamental maintenance.
Yeah.
Changing the oil, swapping out the air filter, putting in a fresh spark plug.
With basics.
Yeah, it might sound like a tune-up for your car,
Yeah.
but it's just as vital for your mower's engine to run efficiently. And then there's the often neglected job of cleaning the mower deck, getting rid of all that built-up grass and debris.
Oh, yeah, that caked on stuff.
For gas mowers, the key is to tilt it carefully to access the underside, just one side up, keeping the carburetor high to prevent flooding.
Good tip. And what's particularly insightful in the guide is the emphasis on having a sharp mower blade.
Ah, yes.
The guide explains that a clean cut is crucial versus like a ragged tear.
Why is that so important?
Well, when the blade tears the grass, it creates more surface area that's vulnerable to fungal spores and disease. And it hinders the lawn's ability to recover quickly. A sharp blade promotes clean healing much faster.
Exactly. And the guide even recommends knowing when it's time to replace the blade entirely.
Right.
And the smart idea of keeping a spare on hand just makes
It's
sense.
always good to have a backup.
And for those who prefer professional servicing, the tip is to schedule it in late fall or winter. Beat the spring rush.
Smart planning, avoid the wait times.
Oh, and a little tip for those chilly Vancouver spring mornings when your mower doesn't want to start. Parking it in a sunny spot for a bit can sometimes do the trick. Just warm it up slightly.
Ah, interesting. All these initial steps really underscore the importance of starting with a good foundation, don't they?
Totally.
A well-maintained mower ensures healthier cutting practices throughout the entire growing season.
Okay, mower prepped and ready to roll. Now for the big cleanup. Winter definitely leaves its mark, doesn't it? Scattered leaves, fallen branches.
Oh, yeah. A bit of a mess sometimes.
All that debris has to go.
And this might seem like just, simple tidying,
Right.
but it's actually crucial for the health of your lawn. Removing that accumulated material allows vital sunlight and air to reach the soil and those emerging grass blades.
And trapped debris can really suffocate the lawn.
Exactly. And given our damp conditions here, it creates a perfect environment for fungal diseases to take hold. Not what you want.
Right. And then comes the gentle raking. The guide mentions removing dead grass, which contributes to the thatch layer. But it also makes an important point that a little bit of thatch is actually a good thing.
That's a really key nuance. A thin layer of thatch, say less than about half an inch,
Okay.
can help the soil retain moisture, provide a bit of cushioning for foot traffic, and even insulate the soil against temperature fluctuations.
So it's not all bad.
No, it only becomes a problem when it builds up excessively.
Which brings us perfectly to aeration. Now, if you've ever tried to dig in Vancouver soil, especially after a stretch of rain, you know all about compaction.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like you're trying to break through concrete.
Precisely. Soil compaction, which is common in high traffic areas and are often clay-rich soil here.
Very clay-rich.
It squeezes out the air pockets and prevents water and nutrients from easily reaching the roots. Aeration, the process of creating small holes or removing plugs of soil, essentially reintroduces those pathways.
It's like giving your lawn the ability to breathe and drink properly again.
Exactly, like opening up pores.
And the payoff.
Yeah.
Stronger, deeper roots, which in the long run means a lawn that's more resilient to dry spells.
Big time. And the guide points out that early spring during the peak growing season is the ideal time to aerate because the lawn recovers so quickly.
A good timing.
And how often you need to do it really depends on your specific lawn. Heavy clay soils or areas with a lot of foot traffic might benefit from annual aeration, while sandy soils or lawns that are generally thriving might only need it every 2 or 3 years.
Right. And you can rent the equipment or hire someone.
Yeah, DIY rental options are available, or you can get professional services to do it for you.
Okay, so we've opened up the soil. Now let's circle back to that thatch layer. When does it cross the line from beneficial to problematic?
As we mentioned, a thin layer, like under half an inch, is fine. But when it gets thicker than about 3/4 of an inch.
Okay, that's the threshold.
Yeah, it starts to act like a barrier. It actually repels water instead of absorbing it.
Right out.
It blocks the flow of essential nutrients and oxygen and can even cause the roots to dry out because they grow up into the thatch instead of down into the soil.
Yikes.
Plus, thick thatch can become a haven for pests and diseases, and it reduces the effectiveness of any fertilizers or pest treatments you apply. They just don't get through.
Sounds like a recipe for a struggling lawn.
Yeah.
So how do we deal with excessive thatch?
That's where dethatching comes in, often using a tool called a power rake.
Okay.
The guide highlights that this is particularly important if you regularly leave your grass clippings on the lawn.
Ah, the mulch mowers.
Right, because those clippings decompose and contribute to thatch buildup over time.
Now, for a classic Vancouver challenge, moss.
Size, yes.
Moss, it seems to flourish in our consistently damp environment.
Absolutely. Our typically damp and often acidic soil provides, well, pretty much ideal conditions for moss to thrive.
Yeah, it loves it here.
And the guide points out that spring is the opportune time to tackle it before it sort of goes dormant during the warmer summer months.
So what's the strategy for getting rid of moss? Is it just scraping it out?
Well, the first step is usually to apply a moss control product. These come in both liquid and granular forms.
Okay.
You'll typically wait a couple of days and you'll see the moss turn black.
Indicating it's dead.
Exactly. That means it's been killed. After that, the dead moss needs to be physically removed, and often a power rake is used for that too.
Okay, get it out of there.
And a crucial follow-up step is to spread a thin layer of topsoil or sand over those bare areas.
Where the moss was.
Right, and then reseed those patches. You want to encourage grass to fill those spaces quickly.
Makes total sense. You want to replace the moss with healthy grass.
Precisely. Don't leave a vacuum.
And speaking of our often acidic soil, the guide talks about the lime advantage. Now, this isn't about squeezing citrus fruit on our lawns, is it?
Laughs slightly. Definitely not. No margaritas for the lawn.
Okay, good.
In this context, lime refers to a soil amendment, usually calcium carbonate or dolomite lime, that helps to neutralize acidity. It essentially raises the soil's pH level.
Why is our soil so acidic here?
Our heavy rainfall in Vancouver plays a big role. It leaches out certain minerals like calcium and magnesium from the soil, which naturally leads to more acidic conditions over time. Applying lime helps to counteract this.
So lime doesn't directly kill the moss, but it creates a less welcoming environment for it.
Exactly.
And helps the grass absorb fertilizer more effectively. Is that the idea?
Precisely. By making the soil less acidic, you're making it more difficult for moss to thrive in the long run. And you're also optimizing the soil conditions for your grass to take up the nutrients it needs to grow strong. Better nutrient uptake.
Okay. When should we apply lime?
The guide recommends applying dolomite lime, which also adds magnesium, in both the spring and the fall for the best results. It works gradually to adjust the pH.
Spring and fall. Got it. Okay, so we've addressed the moss and balanced the soil's pH. What's the next step in giving our lawns a boost? the guide mentions top dressing. What's that?
Top dressing is kind of like a rejuvenating treatment for your lawn. It's usually done after you've aerated or dethatched, maybe around March or April.
Okay.
And it's particularly beneficial for lawns that look a bit thin or uneven.
So what do you use for top dressing?
The type of material you use depends on your existing soil. Peat moss is often recommended for sandy soils to help with water retention.
Right.
A mix of peat and sand can work well for clay soils to improve drainage and structure.
Okay.
And sometimes just sand might be used in consistently wet areas or for general leveling and improvement.
So you just spread a thin layer of this material over the entire lawn.
Exactly. Just a thin layer, maybe a quarter to half an inch, raked in evenly. And the guide points out that following up with overseeding right after top dressing is a great way to fill in any remaining bare patches and really thicken the turf.
Perfect segue. That leads us directly to overseeding itself.
Yeah.
Sowing new grass seed onto your existing lawn. When is the prime window for doing that here in Vancouver?
The guide pegs it as mid-April to mid-May. That seems to be the sweet spot.
And the benefits?
Well, it's a fantastic way to repair those bare spots we've been talking about, obviously, but also to create a denser lawn overall.
Which helps with weeds.
Exactly. A dense lawn will naturally compete better with weeds, crowding them out.
Mm.
Plus, it can even improve your lawn's resistance to pests and diseases. A thicker, healthier stand is just stronger.
Smart. So what kind of grass seed should Vancouverites be looking for? Are there specific types?
Yeah, the guide suggests choosing a seed blend that's well-suited to our maritime climate and the specific conditions of your lawn, like how much sun it gets.
Okay.
Blends containing perennial ryegrass and various fescues are often recommended for their resilience and performance in our region.
And how do you spread it? Just toss it out there.
Well, for even distribution, using a handheld or push spreader is definitely the way to go. Much more consistent.
Right.
And after spreading, a light raking helps to ensure good seed-to-soil contact. But, and this is important, the seeds need sunlight to germinate. So don't bury them too deeply under soil or top dressing. Just gently rake them in.
Good tip. What about starting a brand new lawn from scratch? When's the best time for that?
You'll want to wait until after the risk of frost has passed, which is typically around mid-March here in Vancouver.
Okay.
And for a new lawn to really thrive, the guide emphasizes the importance of having good quality topsoil at least 6 inches deep is recommended.
Minimum 6 inches.
Yes. And ideally even 18 inches if you want to promote really deep roots for better drought tolerance once it's established.
18 inches is a lot.
It is, but it pays off long term. Yeah. And make sure the area is properly tilled and leveled before you sow the seed. Prep is key.
Okay, we've prepped, we've seeded. Now for the fuel that makes it all grow. Fertilizer.
The food.
Spring fertilization is crucial, isn't it? Especially here on the coast with all the rain potentially washing away nutrients.
Precisely. That winter rain really leaches nutrients out of the soil profile. So spring feeding is like giving your lawn that much needed wake-up call after its winter dormancy.
What does it actually do?
It encourages vigorous new growth and helps develop that rich, deep green color we all associate with a healthy lawn.
So what kind of fertilizer should we use in early spring?
The guide recommends an early spring application around March or April with an NPK ratio something like 28:38.
NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium.
Exactly. High nitrogen N for leafy green growth, some phosphorus P for root development, and potassium K for overall plant health and stress tolerance. That kind of ratio gives a good initial boost and typically feeds the lawn for about 10 to 12 weeks.
And how often should we be fertilizing after that initial spring application? Is once enough?
No, usually you'll want to reapply about every 8 weeks throughout the growing season to maintain that vitality.
Okay, every couple of months.
Yeah. And slow-release fertilizers are a really good option. They provide a more consistent supply of nutrients over time, avoiding those sudden bursts of growth followed by a decline.
How do you apply it?
Application is pretty straightforward. Make sure the grass is dry when you apply it. Use a spreader to ensure even coverage. You don't want stripes.
Right.
And then water the fertilizer in thoroughly right afterwards.
Why is watering it in so important?
Two main reasons. It moves the nutrients down off the blades and into the soil where the roots can access them. And it prevents the fertilizer granules from potentially burning the grass blades. Very important step.
And does the aeration and liming we did earlier help with this?
Absolutely. Remember, all those previous steps we've discussed, aeration, opening up the soil, liming, balancing the pH, they actually enhance how effectively your lawn can absorb and utilize those nutrients you're applying. It all works together.
Hydration is next on our list. Watering. We certainly get our fair share of rain here. But what about supplemental watering for the lawn, especially with new seed?
Yes, even with our rain, consistent moisture is absolutely critical for newly seeded areas. For about the first 3 weeks, the guide advises watering lightly but daily.
Daily.
The goal is to keep the soil surface consistently moist but not totally waterlogged. Once the seedlings emerge and start to grow, you can gradually reduce the frequency.
What about newly established lawns, like if you put down sod or did a full seeding?
For those, daily watering might be necessary for a longer period, maybe up to 6 weeks, to really encourage deep and strong root development. You want those roots to go down.
And for lawns that are already established, what's the best watering approach then? Less frequent.
Yes. Water deeply, but less frequently. That's the mantra for established lawns.
Why is that better?
It encourages the roots to grow deeper into the soil, searching for water, which ultimately makes your lawn more resilient and drought-tolerant during drier periods.
How much water are we talking about?
Generally, aiming for about 1 inch of water per week, including any rainfall, is a good target for established lawns.
And the best time to water?
Early in the morning is ideal. It minimizes evaporation loss, and it allows the grass blades to dry out during the day, which helps to prevent fungal diseases. Avoid watering in the evening, if you can, as the lawn stays wet all night.
Good point. And we should always check local watering restrictions, right?
Absolutely. Always be aware of and adhere to any regulations from Metro Vancouver or your local municipality. They change depending on conditions.
And of course, once the grass is actively growing, regular mowing becomes essential. How often should we be giving our lawns a trim?
Every 7 to 10 days is the general guideline during active growth.
Okay.
But you'll need to adjust based on how quickly your grass is growing, which depends on weather, the type of grass, fertilization, lots of factors.
And the cutting height. Should we scalp it?
No, definitely not. Aim to keep the cutting height between 2 and 3 inches for most of the season. Cutting too short stresses the grass.
Right. And sharp blades again.
Yes. We really can't overstate the importance of using those sharp mower blades for a clean, healthy cut. Avoid tearing.
Okay. Message received. Sharp blades. Now, what about the grass clippings? Collect them or leave them? There seems to be debate.
Yeah, the guide outlines the pros and cons. Collecting the clippings helps to prevent the buildup of thatch, which we talked about.
Right.
However, leaving them on the lawn, a practice known as mulch mowing, returns valuable nutrients back to the soil. Like free fertilizer.
So which is better?
It depends. If you choose to mulch mow, you'll likely need to mow more frequently, maybe every 5 days, so the clippings are short and decompose quickly. And you'll need to be more diligent about monitoring thatch and potentially dethatching more regularly.
So it's a trade-off.
Pretty much. Convenience versus thatch management.
It's fascinating how all these different aspects of lawn care are interconnected. It's not just a random list of tasks, is it?
Absolutely not. Think of it as an integrated system. Aeration before seeding and fertilizing makes perfect sense. It creates openings.
Right.
Liming improves the soil chemistry, making the fertilizer more effective. Each step supports the others, leading to a healthier and more vibrant lawn overall.
And for us Vancouverites, the key takeaway seems to be that while our abundant moisture leads to that beautiful green,
which we love,
it also means we need to be extra attentive to nutrient leaching and the potential for moss growth.
Precisely. So regular appropriate fertilization and checking soil pH, maybe liming periodically, are particularly important considerations for us in this climate.
That's why the guide includes that helpful table one, right? The Spring Lawn Care Quick Guide.
Exactly. It summarizes the key tasks and timing specifically geared towards Vancouver conditions, highlighting those crucial factors we need to keep in mind. A great cheat sheet.
Okay. Our lawns are on their way to looking like lush green carpets. Now, let's shift our focus upwards to the vertical elements of the garden, our trees and shrubs. Spring pruning. Why is it such a significant task? It seems like a lot of work.
It can be, but spring pruning is really about giving your woody plants a healthy start to the growing season and shaping them for the future.
How so?
Well, it's the prime time to remove any branches that didn't make it through the winter, those that are dead, damaged, or diseased. That's the 3 Ds.
Dead, damaged, diseased. Got it.
Removing that stuff is crucial for the overall health of the plant and prevents the spread of any potential problems, like diseases or pests that might overwinter there.
So it's like a spring cleaning and a health check all in one for our trees and shrubs.
Exactly. And it also plays a vital role in stimulating healthy new growth by directing the plant's energy to where it's most needed rather than wasting it on weak or dying branches.
Okay.
Plus, by opening up the canopy of the plant through careful pruning, you improve air circulation.
Ah, less chance of fungus.
Precisely. Key to reducing the risk of fungal diseases, especially in our damp climate. And of course, you can enhance the plant's natural shape and structure, which improves its aesthetic appeal.
And it can help with pests too.
It can, yeah. By removing dense, twiggy growth or dead wood, you eliminate potential hiding spots for pests. Ultimately, good pruning leads to more vigorous and resilient plants.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So what are the essential tools we'll need to tackle this pruning project effectively? Just garden shears.
For most home gardeners, you'll want a good quality pair of hand pruners or sekechers for smaller stems up to maybe half an inch.
Okay.
Then the set of loppers, which have longer handles for more leverage for tackling thicker branches, maybe up to an inch and a half or so.
Right.
And for anything larger than that, a pruning saw is the way to go.
And sharp tools are key here too, I assume, like the mower blades.
Absolutely crucial. Just like with your mower blade, it's essential to make sure all your pruning tools have sharp blades. Clean cuts promote faster healing and reduce stress on the plant. Dull blades crush stems, leaving ragged wounds.
And I recall reading something about the importance of keeping those tools clean as well between plants.
That's absolutely vital. Disinfecting your pruning tools, especially between making cuts on different plants or if you know you're cutting out diseased wood,
Yeah.
is essential to prevent the spread of pathogens. Bacteria, fungi, viruses can all be transferred on dirty blades.
How do you disinfect them?
A simple wipe with rubbing alcohol or a diluted bleach solution, about one part bleach to nine parts water, will do the trick. Just wipe the blades clean between plants or after cutting diseased material.
Okay, good hygiene for the garden tools. Now, the guide talks about this concept of a bloom budget when it comes to pruning times. That sounds really interesting. Can you explain that a bit more?
Chuckle slightly. It's just a helpful way to think about when to prune different types of flowering shrubs without accidentally cutting off all their flower buds for the year.
Ah, avoiding pruning disappointment.
Exactly. The crucial factor is whether a shrub flowers on what we call old wood, which means the flower buds were formed on the growth from the previous year.
Okay.
Or new wood, where the flowers will develop on the current season's new shoots that grow this spring.
So pruning at the wrong time could mean no flowers.
Unfortunately, yes. You could prune off all the potential blooms for that year if you get the timing wrong, based on whether it blooms on old or new wood.
Okay, examples, please. What about those beautiful spring flowering shrubs like forsythia and lilacs that burst into color so early? Old wood or new wood?
Those are classic examples of old wood bloomers. The
Yeah.
buds were set last summer and fall.
So.
So you'll want to prune them after they have finished flowering in the spring. Wait for the show to finish.
Okay.
If you prune them any earlier, like in late winter, you'll be removing the very buds that were set last year and would have produced this year's flowers.
Makes sense. Same for rhododendrons and azaleas. They're big spring bloomers here.
Yes, same principle applies. Rhodies and azaleas also bloom on old wood, so prune them shortly after their flowers fade, usually in late spring or early summer.
Got it.
Bloom first, then prune for those early spring stars. What about shrubs that bloom later in the year, say in the summertime, like some hydrangeas?
Right. Many summer flowering shrubs, such as certain types of hydrangeas like the panicle hydrangeas, hydrangea paniculata, or summer blooming spirea, flower on new wood.
Meaning the flowers form on this year's growth.
Exactly, the growth that emerges in the spring. So these are best pruned in late winter or early spring, just before they start putting on that new growth for the season.
Why that?
Pruning at this time actually encourages the development of those vigorous new shoots that will carry the summer flowers. You're basically stimulating the growth that will bloom.
Interesting difference. And what about evergreen trees and shrubs, conifers and things like laurel? They seem to require a bit less attention when it comes to pruning, don't they?
Generally, that's true. Evergreens typically need less routine pruning than deciduous plants. If you do want to shape them or reduce their size, the best time to do so is usually after their main flush of new spring growth has emerged and hardened off a bit, maybe late spring or early summer.
Is there anything to watch out for with evergreens?
Yes, it's really important to remember with many coniferous evergreens, like pines and firs and even some broadleaf ones, that if you cut back into old wood that doesn't have any needles or leaves on it, it often won't regenerate new growth from that point. You'll just have a permanent bare spot. So be cautious not to cut back too hard into old non-leafy wood unless you know the specific plant can handle it.
That's a really important tip to keep in mind. Don't want permanent bare spots. And what about roses? They seem to have their own unique set of rules for just about everything, including pruning.
Chuckles. They certainly do keep us on our toes. The best time to prune roses can vary a bit depending on the specific type. Climbers, floribundas, hybrid teas.
Right.
However, for most common garden roses grown here in Vancouver, a good spring pruning is generally very beneficial, usually done in late winter or early spring, just as the buds begin to swell.
What are you trying to achieve with rose pruning?
You'll want to remove any canes that are dead, damaged, weak, or crossing and rubbing against each other. And also shape the plant to encourage good air circulation and direct energy into producing strong flowering stems. Spring is also the time when you typically fertilize your roses and keep an eye out for any early signs of disease, like black spot.
Okay, so we've got the timing down for different types of plants. Now, what about the actual technique of making the pruning cuts themselves? Any specific way to do it?
Yes, the fundamentals are really important for plant health. Always aim to cut back to just above a healthy outward-facing bud if you're shortening a stem.
Outward-facing, why?
Because the new shoot will grow in the direction the bud is pointing, so an outward-facing bud encourages growth away from the center of the plant, keeping it open.
Makes sense. What if you're removing a whole branch?
When you're removing an entire branch, look for the branch collar, that slightly swollen area where the branch meets a larger branch or the main trunk.
Okay, I think I know what you mean.
You want to make your cut just outside of that collar without damaging the collar itself and without leaving a protruding stub of the branch.
Why is the collar important?
The branch collar contains specialized cells that are essential for the plant to compartmentalize and heal the wound properly after pruning. Cutting into the collar slows healing and invites decay. Leaving a stub also slows healing and can die back.
Branch collar noted. Cut just outside it. And the guide mentions different types of pruning cuts, thinning and heading.
Yes, those are the two main types of cuts you'll make. Thinning cuts involve removing an entire branch right back to its point of origin, either at another branch or the main trunk.
What's the purpose of thinning?
These are primarily used to open up the plant's canopy, improve air circulation, and light penetration. Remember that fungus prevention and reduce the overall density of the plant without drastically reducing its size.
Okay. And heading cuts.
Heading cuts, on the other hand, involve shortening a branch back to a bud or a side branch. These types of cuts are typically used to encourage more bushy growth below the cut, or sometimes to direct the direction of new growth. You use them more for shaping or size control.
So thinning cuts for more space and light, heading cuts for more fullness or directing growth. That makes sense. And the first rule of pruning club seems to be...
Chuckles. The three Ds. Always start by identifying and removing any wood that is dead, damaged, or diseased.
Get the bad stuff out first.
Exactly. That's the essential first step in any pruning task, regardless of the type of plant or the time of year. Clean up the problems before you start shaping.
All right. Our trees and shrubs are looking well-shaped and healthy. Ready for the season? Now for the really exciting part, I think, adding some color to our yards.
Yes, planting time.
Let's talk about planting for a vibrant Vancouver spring display. It's like starting with a fresh canvas, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the secret to a truly dynamic and long-lasting spring garden isn't just picking pretty flowers, it's planning for a succession of blooms.
Succession, meaning...
Think about selecting a variety of plants that will flower at different times early spring, mid-spring, late spring. That way, you have a continuous show of color from the very first signs of spring right through to the later months, not just one big burst and then it's over.
Like a floral calendar unfolding in our yards.
Yeah.
Smart. What else should we consider when we're planning our spring planting beyond just bloom time?
The interplay of height, structure, and texture is absolutely crucial for creating visual interest and depth in your garden beds.
How so?
Consider placing plants with different forms alongside each other, for example. The tall, vertical spikes of foxgloves can create a lovely contrast with the more mounding shapes of, say, hellebores or some perennials.
Okay, different shapes.
Even the texture of the foliage plays a role. The delicate, lacy leaves of columbine offer a very different feel than plants with bolder, more substantial leaves like rhododendrons or hostas later on. Contrast is key.
It's all about creating a visually appealing and harmonious composition, like painting with plants. And the most important principle, it seems, woven throughout the guide, is always right plant, right place.
Absolutely fundamental. Can't stress that enough. Before you even start thinking about which beautiful flowers you want to plant, you really need to take stock of your garden's specific conditions.
Like what specifically?
How much sunlight does each area receive throughout the day? Full sun, part shade, deep shade. What's the soil like? Is it sandy and fast draining, heavy clay that holds onto moisture, or something in between? Is it acidic, neutral, alkaline?
And conditions can vary even in one yard, right?
Exactly. Given Vancouver's diverse microclimates, the conditions can vary quite significantly even within a relatively small property. The front yard might be different from the back.
So matching plants to conditions is key for them to thrive.
It's non-negotiable for their long-term health and success. Choosing plants whose needs perfectly match your local conditions means less work for you and happier plants. Ignoring this often leads to plants that constantly struggle, get diseased, or just fail to perform.
Okay, lesson learned. So let's talk about some specific spring bloomers that tend to do well here. Perennial plants and spring flowering bulbs really form the backbone of a spring garden, don't they?
They really do, and Vancouver's climate seems to be quite hospitable to a wide variety of them, thankfully.
So give us some examples for perennials. Early spring, maybe.
For perennials that shine in early spring, think of things like grape hyacinth, muscari, with their lovely, dense spikes of blue-violet flowers. Very reliable.
Pretty easy to care for.
Relatively low maintenance, yeah. Mm-hmm. An annual feed, cut back after flowering. Just be aware they can spread readily by bulb offsets and seeding, so you might want to consider planting them in pots or contained areas if you want to control their spread.
Good tip. What else for early to mid-spring?
Then you have the iconic tulips, of course. Incredible array of colors, forms, heights. And they offer different bloom times early, mid, late spring, so you can plan for a prolonged display just with tulips.
What do tulips need?
Generally, full sun, well-draining soil, slightly acidic is fine. The main challenge here can be wildlife.
Squirrels and deer.
Exactly. They can be a favorite snack, so you might need to take some protective measures like cages when planting or using deterrents. Daffodils are another classic and cheerful choice, often planted alongside tulips for succession of bloom. Yellows, whites, oranges.
And are daffodils easier with pests?
Generally, much more resistant to wildlife, yes. They contain toxins that critters tend to avoid. Similar care. Fertilize when planting or as growth emerges. Let the foliage die back naturally after blooming to feed the bulb for next year.
Okay. What comes after the tulips and daffodils? Late spring perennials.
Columbines, aquilegia, are a beautiful choice for late spring. They have these really unique, intricate, spurred flowers come in various colors and add height and a delicate structure.
Do they attract anything?
Oh, yes. They're known to attract hummingbirds and butterflies. And interestingly, some species are even native to the Pacific Northwest, making them particularly well-adapted and easy to care for here. Partial shade, well-draining soil is usually good for them.
Nice. Any others for shady spots or early bloom?
Hellebores, often called Lenten roses or Christmas roses, are remarkable. They bloom very early in the spring, sometimes even pushing up through late snow.
Wow.
They have lovely nodding flowers, often in muted shades of white, green, pink, purple. Prefer well-draining soil, partial shade typically. And another bonus, they're toxic, so generally deer and other wildlife leave them alone.
Good to know. What about something tall and dramatic?
Then there are the stately foxgloves, Digitalis. Tall spires of tubular flowers, very striking in borders or woodland settings, also native to our region.
But toxic, right?
Yes. Important to remember they are toxic if ingested. Handle with care, especially around kids and pets. They thrive in full sun to part shade and are quite adaptable to different soil types as long as it's not overly dry or constantly waterlogged.
And of course, we have to mention rhododendrons and azaleas.
Absolutely. They're hallmarks of Vancouver spring gardens, putting on such a spectacular show of color. They need acidic soil to thrive, so amending soil or using acid-based fertilizers in spring is often necessary here.
What's the general care for perennials after they bloom?
For most spring-blooming perennials, cutting them back after they finish flowering, maybe down to about 3 inches or so, can help to keep the garden looking tidy. Sometimes it even encourages a second, smaller flush of blooms later in the season, depending on the plant.
So a real abundance of choices for adding spring color. And what about those spring flowering bulbs like tulips and daffodils? We typically plant them in the fall, right? Can we plant any in spring?
Well, fall is the traditional planting time for most spring flowering bulbs to give them the chilling period they need.
Right.
You can sometimes find pre-chilled bulbs or even potted bulbs that are already growing or in bloom at garden centers in the spring.
For instant gratification.
Exactly. These can give you an immediate burst of color if you missed fall planting or just want quick results. Just make sure to plant them at the correct depth, which is usually about 2 to 3 times the height of the bulb itself, and with appropriate spacing between them.
And for that really instant splash of vibrant color, we can always rely on bedding annuals, right? Pansies, primulas.
Exactly. Once the soil has warmed up sufficiently and the risk of hard frost has passed, which can be fairly early here for cool season annuals like pansies and primulas, you can plant a wide variety of bedding annuals. They provide immediate and often long-lasting color throughout the spring and often into summer. Just keep them well watered, especially when establishing.
Can we grow any annuals from seeds sown directly in spring?
Yes, some hardy annuals like calendula, cosmos, sweet peas, poppies. Their seeds can often be sown directly into the garden soil in spring for blooms a bit later in the season. Check the seed packet for timing.
The guide also mentions the technique of layering when we're planting, particularly with bulbs. What's the main benefit of doing that? Sounds complex.
It's not too complex, really. Layering, sometimes called lasagna planting, involves planting bulbs at different depths within the same area, often in pots, but works in beds too.
Why do that?
It maximizes the use of space, for one, but the main benefit is creating that continuous display of blooms we talked about earlier. Different types of bulbs bloom at different times and require different planting depths.
So you put later bloomers deeper.
Exactly. You might plant larger, later blooming bulbs like tulips or alliums deeper in the soil, maybe put some mid-season daffodils above them, and then smaller, earlier blooming bulbs like crocus or grape hyacinths closest to the surface.
Like a tiered effect over time.
Right. As one layer finishes, the next one starts to emerge. It creates a more dynamic and longer-lasting floral display. Plus, it can provide a more sustained source of nectar and pollen for pollinators visiting your garden.
Very clever. And for
Yes.
those of us who enjoy growing our own food, what about planting spring vegetables here in Vancouver? Can we start tomatoes now?
Probably a bit early for tomatoes outdoors. For those warm season vegetable crops like eggplant, melons, tomatoes, peppers, squash, you really need to wait until the soil has consistently warmed up to above 21 degrees C, which is around 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
When is that usually here?
In Vancouver, that often means planting those heat lovers will occur in late spring or even early summer, maybe late May or June, depending on the year. So patience is key. Or you need to start seeds indoors much earlier to get a head start.
What can we plant earlier in spring?
You can definitely get a head start with cool season vegetables, things like lettuce, spinach, kale, peas, radishes, arugula, Swiss chard. They actually prefer cooler temperatures and can often be sown directly in the garden or planted out as seedlings much earlier in the spring, sometimes even late winter if the soil is workable.
Okay, cool season greens and roots early, warm season fruits later. What are some essential planting tips that will help ensure our spring plantings thrive, whether flowers or veggies?
Okay, three key things. First, thorough soil preparation. We keep coming back to soil, don't we?
Seems important.
It is. Amend your soil generously with compost and other well-rotted organic matter. This improves its structure, drainage, aeration, and overall fertility, gives plants the best start.
Second.
Second, consider the mature size of the plants you're choosing. Read the plant tag. Avoid overcrowding.
Why is spacing so important?
Overcrowding leads to competition for sunlight, water, and nutrients. It also causes poor air circulation, which, again, increases the risk of fungal diseases. Make sure you allow adequate spacing between plants based on their expected width and height at maturity. Give them room to grow.
Okay, and third.
Third, water all your new plantings thoroughly immediately after putting them in the ground.
Right away.
Yes. This helps to settle the soil around the roots, eliminating air pockets, and provides that essential initial moisture to help them establish quickly. Don't let new transplants dry out.
Great tips. And just like with the lawn care, the guide features a really helpful table too that summarizes recommended spring plants for Vancouver gardens, a fantastic quick reference.
Yes. Table 2 is a great resource. It highlights some excellent plant choices, perennials, bulbs, shrubs that are generally well suited to our local conditions. It covers things like their preferred sun exposure, typical bloom times, mature size, and maybe any special features or care requirements. Really useful for planning.
Okay, we've got our lawns looking great, our trees and shrubs are well pruned, and our garden beds are filled, or soon to be filled, with vibrant spring plantings. Now, how do we nurture this thriving garden so it continues to flourish? The guide speaks very highly about the magic of mulch.
And it truly is one of the most beneficial practices for creating a low-maintenance and resilient garden. Applying a layer of organic mulch around your plants, things like bark chips, shredded leaves, compost, sea soil.
Lots of options.
Yes, lots of options. It offers a surprising number of advantages. It's not just decorative.
So what makes mulch so magical in the garden? What does it actually do?
It performs so many important functions simultaneously. Firstly, it helps the soil retain moisture by significantly reducing evaporation from the surface.
So less watering needed.
Exactly, which means you won't have to water as frequently, saving water and time. Secondly, it acts as an insulator, helping to regulate soil temperature, keeping roots cooler in the heat of summer and slightly warmer during cold snaps.
Okay, moisture and temperature. What else?
And perhaps most noticeably for many gardeners, it's a fantastic weed suppressant.
How does it stop weeds?
A good layer of mulch blocks sunlight from reaching weed seeds in the soil, preventing many of them from germinating in the first place. And any that do manage to sprout are usually easier to pull from the loose mulch layer.
Nice. Any other benefits?
Yes. As organic mulches like bark or compost decompose over time, they gradually break down and add valuable organic matter to your soil, improving its structure and fertility year after year. It feeds the soil life.
When is the best time to apply mulch?
The best time is typically in the spring, once the soil has warmed up a bit from winter, and ideally after you've done a thorough weeding of the area. You don't want to mulch over existing weeds.
How thick should the mulch layer be?
Aim for a layer that's about 2 to 4 inches thick, enough to suppress weeds and retain moisture, but not so thick that it prevents air and water from reaching the soil.
And apply it right up to the plant stems.
No, that's an important point. Make sure to keep the mulch pulled back a few inches away from the base of plant stems, tree trunks, and shrub crowns.
Why is that?
Piling mulch right up against the stems can trap too much moisture there, creating conditions that favor rot, fungal diseases, and even pests like slugs or rodents finding shelter. Give plants some breathing room at the base.
Makes perfect sense. We don't want to smother our plants at the crown.
Yeah.
Now let's talk about weeds, the ongoing battle for every gardener, even with mulch. How do we effectively win that war, or at least manage it?
Winning might be optimistic, but managing is key. The most effective strategy is diligence. Tackle weeds when they are still small and young, before they have a chance to establish deep roots or, crucially, flower and produce seeds. One weed going to seed can mean hundreds or thousands next year.
So get them while they're young. What's the best way?
Regular hand weeding, where you carefully pull out weeds, making sure to get the entire root system, is always a good approach for selective removal, especially in garden beds. Best done when the soil is moist, as they often pull out easier.
And mulch helps prevent them in the first place.
Exactly. Remember that layer of mulch we just discussed? That's a powerful preventative measure against many annual weeds. It's your first line of defense.
What about weeds in the lawn? Hand-pulling dandelions can take forever.
True. For weeds that pop up in your lawn, there are various selective lawn weed control products available, herbicides designed to target broadleaf weeds without harming the grass.
Anything to watch out for with those?
Yes, it's crucial to choose the right product for the type of weeds you have and the type of grass in your lawn. Always read and follow the label instructions very carefully regarding application rates, timing, and safety precautions. Misuse can damage your lawn or be harmful.
Right. Targeted action and careful use is often the best approach there. What about those other uninvited guests? Pests, slugs, aphids. How do we manage them in a healthy way without resorting to harsh chemicals immediately?
Well, the first principle, echoing the guide, is that a healthy and thriving garden is actually your first and best line of defense against pests.
Huss.
Strong, vigorous plants grown in good conditions are naturally less susceptible to infestations and can often tolerate minor pest damage without significant harm. Stressed plants are easy targets.
Okay, healthy plants first. Then what?
Then regular inspection of your plants is key. Walk around your garden frequently, turn over leaves, look closely for any early signs of common garden pests, aphids on new growth, holes in leaves indicating slugs or caterpillars, mole tunnels in the lawn.
Why is early detection so important?
Early detection allows you to intervene with less drastic and more targeted measures before the population explodes and causes major damage. Much easier to deal with a few aphids than thousands.
The guide touches on the principles of integrated pest management, or IPM. What's the gist of that?
IPM is a really smart approach. It emphasizes using a combination of methods, starting with the least toxic and most sustainable options first, to control pests effectively while minimizing risks to beneficial organisms and the environment. It's about managing pests, not necessarily eradicating them entirely.
Like encouraging beneficial insects. Does that really work?
It absolutely can. Insects like ladybugs and their larvae devour aphids, lacewings eat various pests, hoverflies, parasitic wasps. They're natural predators.
How do you encourage them?
By creating a diverse habitat in your garden, planting a variety of flowers that provide nectar and pollen, avoiding broad-spectrum insecticides that kill beneficials along with pests, and providing sources of water.
So, if we do need to intervene, what are the less toxic options?
Start with physical controls like handpicking larger pests like slugs or caterpillars, using strong water sprays to dislodge aphids, or setting up physical barriers like copper tape for slugs or floating row covers for certain veggie pests.
Okay, yep. What about sprays?
Then you might move to less toxic insecticidal options like insecticidal soaps or horticultural oils, which work by smothering soft-bodied insects and have low impact on beneficials when used carefully. Bacillus thuringiensis, B. honey, is a biological control effective against caterpillars.
So the goal is ecosystem management, not just spraying.
Exactly. The goal is to shift towards a more proactive approach of managing your garden's ecosystem to create a healthier balance, which naturally reduces pest problems and minimizes your reliance on chemical interventions.
Now, we've talked about watering the lawn, but what's the best strategy for watering our established garden beds, perennials, shrubs, to keep everything healthy and, importantly, conserve water?
The core principle remains the same as for lawns. Water deeply, but less frequently.
Why deep and infrequent for beds, too?
It encourages plants to develop deeper and more extensive root systems, making them more resilient to drought and less dependent on constant surface watering. Shallow, frequent watering encourages shallow roots.
And timing. Still early morning.
Yes, early morning is still the optimal time to water garden beds. It minimizes water loss to evaporation and allows the plant foliage to dry out relatively quickly during the day, which, again, reduces the risk of fungal diseases taking hold on wet leaves.
What's the best way to water beds? Sprinklers.
For garden beds, overhead sprinklers can be inefficient. A lot of water evaporates or lands on foliage where it's not needed. Consider using drip irrigation systems or soaker hoses instead.
Why are they better?
These methods are much more efficient because they deliver water slowly and directly to the root zone, right where the plants need it. They minimize water loss through evaporation and runoff, and they keep the foliage dry, further reducing disease risk. Better for the plants, better for your water bill.
Even with all the spring rain we get here, we still need to think about drainage in our gardens, don't we?
Hey.
Especially with heavy downpours.
Absolutely. While the spring rain is certainly welcome for nourishing our plants, really heavy downpours, which seem increasingly common, can sometimes lead to waterlogging in poorly drained areas.
And waterlogging is bad because
it's detrimental to root health. Plant roots need oxygen to function, and waterlogged soil has very little airspace. Roots can essentially drown, leading to rot and plant death. Good drainage is crucial.
So how do we ensure good drainage?
First, ensure your property's overall drainage is functioning. Make sure your gutters and downspouts are clear of debris and directing rainwater away from your house foundation and also away from low-lying or vulnerable garden areas if possible.
What about paved areas?
For patios and walkways, consider using permeable paving materials like gravel, interlocking pavers with gaps, or permeable concrete. Mm. These allow rainwater to soak into the ground naturally instead of running off rapidly.
And in the garden beds themselves.
And as we've mentioned before, consistently incorporating plenty of organic matter compost, aged manure, into your soil is one of the best ways to improve its structure. Organic matter helps both clay soils drain better and sandy soils retain moisture better. It improves porosity. Raised beds can also be a solution for areas with very poor drainage.
Okay, we've covered the practical aspects of spring gardening in Vancouver lawns: pruning, planting, nurturing. Now, let's delve a little deeper into what makes gardening here so unique. Vancouver's vernal virtues. I like the sound of that.
Chuckle slightly. It does capture the essence of gardening here in springtime, doesn't it? Our climate in Vancouver during spring is really a fascinating transition period.
How so?
We move from a typically mild and very wet winter into warmer, although often still quite showery, conditions in spring. That sheer abundance of moisture is truly what fuels the incredible lushness and greenery that our region is famous for. Everything just wants to grow.
But all that rain also presents some specific challenges for us gardeners, doesn't it? It's not all easy.
It certainly does. As we discussed with lawns, the persistent rainfall can leach essential nutrients, particularly mobile ones like nitrogen, right out of the soil profile. That's why regular, appropriate fertilization is often more important here than in drier climates.
Okay, nutrient leaching. What else?
It can also contribute to soil compaction over time, just the physical impact of raindrops on bare soil. And as we know, it tends to push our already often slightly acidic soils even further towards acidity.
Which highlights the importance of
regular aeration to combat compaction and testing soil pH periodically, perhaps applying lime as needed to balance that acidity and improve nutrient availability.
And drainage again.
And yes, ensuring good drainage in your garden beds is absolutely critical to prevent that waterlogged soil, which can deprive roots of oxygen and lead to root rot, especially during prolonged wet spells in spring or fall.
So when we're making our plant choices for our Vancouver gardens, we should really be prioritizing those that are naturally well suited to these specific conditions. Happy with wet feet sometimes, okay with acid soil.
Exactly. Opting for plants that are naturally well adapted to wet winters and springs and often prefer or at least tolerate slightly acidic soil conditions is a smart strategy for long-term success and reduced maintenance. Less fighting against nature.
Like the native plants we mentioned.
Yes, many of our beautiful native plants, like certain varieties of columbine, bleeding heart, sword ferns, salal, Oregon grape, even foxgloves, they're perfectly adapted to these conditions and often require much less intervention once established.
What about non-natives?
Many non-natives thrive here too, of course. Rhododendrons, azaleas, camellias, many hydrangeas love the conditions. When it comes to choosing lawn seed, those blends that include perennial ryegrass and fescues are recommended for their resilience in our cool, moist climate. And when you're considering other non-native plants, it's always a good idea to do a little research. Check their tolerance for moisture, their preferred pH range, and be prepared to amend your soil if necessary to meet their needs.
So it all comes back to
that fundamental principle, right plant, right place. Matching the plant to the site conditions is key for a more sustainable and thriving garden with less struggle.
It might seem a little counterintuitive to talk about water conservation in a region known for its rain, but the guide suggests it's still an important consideration, isn't it? Even here.
It absolutely is for a couple of reasons. While spring is often wet, we can certainly experience extended dry periods in the summer. Our rainfall isn't evenly distributed throughout the year.
Right. Summers can get quite dry.
So practicing water-wise gardening techniques year-round is not only environmentally responsible, but it also helps to prepare your garden and yourself for potential water restrictions later in the season when demand is high and supplies might be lower.
What are those water-wise practices again?
Adhering to any watering regulations set by Metro Vancouver is step one. Utilizing water-efficient irrigation methods like drip systems and soaker hoses instead of sprinklers. Mulching your garden beds deeply to retain soil moisture. Improving your soil with organic matter so it holds water better. And choosing drought-tolerant plants where appropriate, especially for sunny, exposed areas once they become established.
Okay, makes sense. Finally, the guide touches on some common garden issues we often encounter here in Vancouver. We've already talked quite a bit about moss and lawns due to the damp, acidic soil. What about some of those other garden nuisances we might face? Slugs seem notorious here.
Yes. Slugs and snails. They definitely thrive in our damp climate, don't they? They can cause significant damage, especially to young, tender seedlings and leafy greens like hostas or lettuce. They seem to love hostas.
They really do.
Yeah.
So how do we deal with them? The source doesn't go into huge detail, but what are common methods?
Some common approaches include going out at night or early morning with a flashlight for handpicking sessions.
The slug hunt.
Yes. Using physical barriers like copper tape around pots or beds, they reportedly don't like crossing it, or rings of sharp material like diatomaceous earth or crushed eggshells, though their effectiveness can be variable, especially when wet. Setting up traps, like shallow dishes filled with beer sunk into the soil, can attract and drown them.
And safer baits.
There are baits available now based on iron phosphate, which are considered much safer for pets, wildlife, and the environment than the older metaldehyde baits. And encouraging natural predators like ground beetles, frogs, garter snakes, and certain types of birds can also help to keep slug and snail populations in check over the long term. A balanced ecosystem helps.
So it really sounds like all these spring efforts we put into our Vancouver yards aren't just about making things look beautiful, right now, in the moment.
No, not at all.
They're truly laying the groundwork, building the foundation for a healthy and resilient garden that will thrive through the entire growing season.
Exactly.
And maybe even help us prepare for the challenges of summer, like potential drought or pests.
Precisely. It's all interconnected. Improving the soil health with compost and aeration, making thoughtful plant choices suited to our climate, implementing good maintenance practices like mulching and proper pruning, being mindful of water use. Mm. Those spring tasks provide the essential foundation for a flourishing garden that can better withstand whatever the seasons may bring. You're investing in future success.
Okay, let's quickly recap the key benefits of all this spring action in our Vancouver yards. It sounds like the rewards extend well beyond just a pretty spring display, reaching throughout the entire growing season and maybe even improving the garden year over year.
Absolutely. By investing your time and effort in these spring tasks, the lawn care, the pruning, the planting, the soil building, you're not just creating that immediate, beautiful visual spectacle.
Which is nice.
Which is very nice. But you're also building a healthier, more resilient, and ultimately more enjoyable garden space. It becomes more self-sustaining and rewarding, requiring potentially less intervention down the line. It will reward you with its beauty and productivity for many months to come.
So from giving our lawns that proper revival after winter and getting those pruning shears working their magic.
Mm-hmm. Shaping things up.
To carefully selecting and planting for that explosion of spring color and providing that essential ongoing nurture with mulch and smart watering. It certainly sounds like a busy time for Vancouver gardeners, but incredibly rewarding work.
It can be busy, yes. But the key is to approach these tasks in a systematic way. Don't feel overwhelmed by the entire list all at once.
Break it down.
Exactly. Break it down into manageable steps. Maybe focus on the lawn one weekend, pruning the next. Tackle it one area or one task at a time, and you'll be truly amazed at the transformation of your yard into a vibrant and thriving haven.
And there's such a deep sense of satisfaction, isn't there, in witnessing it all come together. Seeing those first new shoots emerging from the soil, watching the plants put on robust growth after pruning, the vibrant burst of blooms opening up. It feels like nature directly responding to your care and effort.
It truly is. That's the magic of it, I think. Gardening is so much more than just a set of chores or tasks to tick off a list.
Right.
It's an engaging and incredibly rewarding journey. It's a tangible way to connect with the natural rhythms of our local environment, to partner with nature, and experience the wonder of growth firsthand.
So, spring landscaping in Vancouver, all these efforts we've discussed, really sets the stage for an entire season of beauty, growth, and enjoyment. It fosters that continuous and enriching relationship with our unique Pacific Northwest gardens.
Well said. It's about building that relationship.
And for you listening, as you maybe look out at your own yard right now or plan your gardening tasks, what small but meaningful step will you take today or this weekend to deepen that connection and cultivate even more vibrancy in your little corner of this beautiful region?
Yeah, what's one thing you can do?
It's certainly something wonderful to contemplate as we fully embrace this glorious season of renewal.